Today at Reader's Corner, Terry Williams, author of The Odyssey of KP2, An Orphan Seal, A Marine Biologist, and The Fight to Save a Species.
Suddenly, there's this bond that develops between this wild seal and these children, and he becomes a summer playmate for them. Unlike other seals that live in cold water, because these animals live in warm water, they're almost like petting a puppy. You know, they're just warm to the touch as opposed to feeling sort of cold and clammy like all the other seals. KP2 had no other options. He was abandoned by his mom. He became, in a way, a pest around humans. As dogs were coming into the water, there was this huge fear that suddenly you'd get the transmission of dog diseases to a monk seal, and that could get transferred to a wild population.
I'm Bob Custer, president of Boise State University. Welcome to Reader's Corner. In 2008, a young monk seal, abandoned on a sandy Hawaiian beach, captured the hearts of locals and tourists alike. Playful and inquisitive, the seal quickly developed a love for all things human. When local fishermen objected to his presence, officials made an unprecedented decision to move him across the ocean to the Santa Cruz, California laboratory of a marine biologist. Today's guest, Terry Williams, is the scientist who had the rare opportunity to study the monk seal at close quarters. She recounts her experiences in her memoir, The Odyssey of KP2, An Orphan Seal, A Marine Biologist, and The Fight to Save a Species. Dr. Williams' book is this year's campus read at Boise State, and I'm pleased to announce that she'll be visiting our campus in early March. She will present a lecture open to the public on Tuesday, March 3rd, in the Simplot Ballroom in the Student Union Building. Check boisestate.edu for more details. As part of her visit, Dr. Williams will also engage with students and the community in a variety of settings, including classroom visits and a tour of Zoo Boise. Today we're featuring an encore edition of our interview with Dr. Williams. She is director of the Marine Mammal Physiology Project at the University of California, Santa Cruz, and a co-creator of the Center for Ocean Health. Her book, The Odyssey of KP2, is now out in paperback. Dr. Williams joins us by phone from her office at UC Santa Cruz. Terry Williams, welcome to Reader's Corner.
Oh my gosh, what an intro. Thank you. It's terrific being here.
Well, it's just terrific hearing your voice after reading your book. I had so much fun reading the book, everything from laughter to tearing up. And I must say, it's not often, hardly ever, do I read a book where I have to go to the end and find out what's going to happen. I read mysteries and thrillers all the time, and I would never ruin it for myself. But I had to know, where was this pup seal going to wind up? Because as you're reading in the beginning, you're not quite sure how this is going to turn out, good or bad. So I go to the end of it, and I learn that I can visit him this Christmas when Boise State is playing in a basketball tournament in Hawaii. Good old KP2's at the Waikiki Aquarium. I can go see him, can I?
You can. He's swimming around entertaining folks, bringing the entire basketball team.
Well, that's great. We're delighted to know that we've got that to look forward to. How old is the Hawaiian monk seal? He certainly predates humans by a large amount.
Absolutely. We're talking by millions and millions of years. So that has actually been a controversy. Who showed up first, the monk seals or the humans? And which one is the invasive species? And truth is, monk seals were there millions of years before humans set foot in Hawaii.
And to get more specific, you're referring, I would assume, to some references in the book to the fishermen who are trying to make a living around these islands. And they think, of course, that these Hawaiian monk seals are stealing their catch.
It's a very tough situation out there because you do have a local population, and not just, you know, the local people, but also recreational fishermen that come in from around the world. And if you have a limited number of fish, who do you feed? Do you take care of human families or do you take care of monk seal families? And what our science is trying to do is say, well, maybe you can feed both. Maybe the competition isn't as great as people imagine.
Mm-hmm. So describe the Hawaiian monk seal for us. I guess for folks listening to this show, you know, maybe they see a seal when they get down to San Francisco or somewhere on the West Coast. This is a different variety.
It is. The monk seal is really quite silvery in its look, and it has this beautiful sort of two-tone look about it. It's got a white belly and then, as I said, sort of a silver back. Huge whiskers. Oh, my gosh. One of the things that we couldn't believe was how long the whiskers can grow on these guys. And we think it's for sort of hunting around coral reefs and mucking around the bottom of the ocean in Hawaii. And compared to other seals that I've worked with, the one thing that really struck me about them was, one, they have a cute face, but two, their eyes were smaller. And that's led me to question about their diving capability. Can they really see at depth where you normally need a large eye to basically capture as much light as you can? And so here's a seal that has a pretty small eye. We've never measured really the capability of diving for these animals, but my guess is that they can hold their breath, but they're not a real deep diver. So as seals go, they still have pretty big heads. You know, if you go see KP2 now, he looks big, and actually the monk seal that we have right now, KE18, his head's bigger than a basketball. It's just massive. But yeah, I like them, and the other side of it is, unlike other seals that live in cold water, because these animals live in warm water, they're almost like petting a puppy. You know, they're just warm to the touch as opposed to feeling sort of cold and clammy like all the other seals.
Well, now, you've tried for years to get one of these Hawaiian monk seals for research, but that's very difficult, I suppose, mainly because they are endangered and officials are leery of any interference. What was the exception for KP2?
KP2 had no other options. He was abandoned by his mom. He became, in a way, a pest around humans because he liked humans. He became very attached to kids and to other people that liked the water like himself. So he's hanging around surfers and kayakers and that kind of thing. And I think as dogs were coming into the water, there was this huge fear that suddenly you'd get the transmission of dog diseases to a monk seal that happened to be around the dog, and that could get transferred to a wild, naive population, and you could wipe out every single animal there.
Like rabies, for example.
Exactly. So the National Marine Fisheries Service decided that they had to bring this seal in, and the problem was there was no place to put them. Absolutely nowhere left in Hawaii. They have a couple of small aquariums and parks, but there was no home for the seal. So the options were pretty slim for KP2. And there was a search that went on amongst the various aquariums in the mainland U.S. and then to my lab, because I'd been putting in a permit request for 14 years saying, I really would like to do some research on this species. I think we can do something here. And finally, it just happened. And I think it was because our facility can heat salt water, which most other aquariums can't. So we could create Hawaii in Santa Cruz, California.
So KP2, how'd you get that name?
KP2, it's just an identification number, so it's Kauai Pup 2. He was the second pup born in that particular year, 2008, on Kauai. So that's it. Nothing
right.
Exotic.
Right. And didn't he also have a sister that came before him, but his mother didn't handle that too well either? Or did she? Maybe she did.
Exactly. He had a sister that died the year before. It was one of the reasons that National Marine Fisheries felt really strongly about taking in an orphaned animal, because after 24 hours, it was clear that she was not going to feed him. And in fact, there were two brothers that happened in the years subsequent to KP2. And his mother finally learned how to feed her pups, and they were weaned. They did great for a while. One is still out there, and one, unfortunately, succumbed to actually entanglement, fishing hook and line, and that was sort of the sad story. That was crushing for us to learn last November.
Does that happen fairly often when it comes to the Hawaiian monk seal fishing in those Hawaiian waters?
It actually is one of the main problems in terms of this species. That the sad truth is we may lose them for nothing more than our garbage, and that is untenable for me. I just can't stand the idea of pollution being the thing that wipes out a species. But the entanglements are happening every single day. There are huge programs to try and clean up the debris that are on the beaches in Hawaii. And as the only islands out in the middle of the Pacific there, they catch everything, including the debris from the Japanese tsunami now. So it's a massive problem, and one that I think is solvable. One, by cleaning up the debris that's out there, and secondly, I think we need some really creative people to figure out new kinds of nets and new kinds of lines that could be used here where all marine mammals would be safeguarded. And I'm not entirely sure how that would work, you know, dissolvable things over time or something that's run with batteries. I know it sounds insane, but it's not just the monk seals, it's dolphins and whales and everything else that you hear about. You go to the most exotic, remote places in the world, and you're going to see lines and such on the beaches. You know, in the top of Alaska, I found it. So, yeah, it's a problem.
I'm speaking today with Terry Williams, the author of The Odyssey of KP2, An Orphan Seal, A Marine Biologist, and The Fight to Save a Species. Well, I'm a fisherman and read these bass magazines, and I got to tell you, they're going in the opposite direction, because if you read...
Yeah, the longer, the better.
Yeah, and they're making this stuff, you know, out of these oil-based, petroleum-based products now, and it's all this artificial stuff that will last forever. It's no longer the old cloth fishing line that I knew when I was a kid. And, you know, loons get caught in it, ducks of any kind. I mean, it's not... obviously not just about seals. This is a wildlife, marine wildlife, very serious issue.
It is, and it's something that I think one could solve creatively. Since I'm not a petroleum chemist, it seems to me that there are ways that we could do this. And yes, there will always be hooks, but the ability to get the line out of the environment, that's what we need to solve here. And shoot, if I was making nets and filament line, what better thing to do than create something that's going to dissolve, because you're going to sell more.
Right, exactly.
So maybe that's where we need to go.
Yeah. So KP2's mother didn't want him around for very long, and this, I guess, you can explain to us, but I guess it's not uncommon for Hawaiian monk seal mothers. They go through their kids pretty quickly. It's not like the helicopter parents we have here who keep an eye on their students even after they show up at the first year of college.
That's it. They get 6 weeks. That's it.
Yeah, right, exactly. But with the mother seal in this case, it's possible, I guess, that by her not taking care of him, that's one of the reasons why you were eventually to get him, because he had some problems physically.
Well, that has been the big mystery here. He came in, or one of the reasons he came in was because he also had the cataracts that were beginning to develop. And the reason he is not out in the wild today is because those cataracts were growing. The realization was there that he would eventually go blind, or at least have really poor vision, and that he would not do well out in the wild. So, yeah, you know, you have to wonder, did mom sense that? Of course, his sister didn't show any problems of that. He initially didn't show those problems. So it would be pretty remarkable for a mom to figure out that eventually there would be a physical problem with her young. In this particular case, she had a lot of suitors that were hanging out in the water, and she just seemed to prefer the company of boys as opposed to her own kids, which is sort of sad.
Yeah. So in the 2 years that you worked with him, how would you rate his, how would you describe his blindness or his lack of perfect eyesight, whatever end of the spectrum you want to talk about?
We were figuring that it was as if he was operating in a low light room. He had some vision. We knew that he could detect motion. So if you walked into his pool area, he knew you were there immediately. But you also saw him use his other sensory modalities. So his whiskers became very important. He would touch all the toys and the sides of the pool and that kind of thing. And even yourself, he would use his whiskers to get a sense of where you were. And then hearing was really important. So that any sound, it was like a dog, you know, his head would up and he'd go running over to, or I guess swimming over, to wherever a sound had occurred. And we actually used that in our training. So when we were working with him, instead of giving a hand signal that you might to a dolphin or a sea lion, we would use that hand signal plus a voice command or a whistle or something like that, or even people sort of banging on the side of a tank if you're trying to get him to move from one area or another, and just recognize that as a limitation, but one that he hid well enough that it would fool you to think that he was fully sighted.
I was really surprised to learn that he didn't know how to swim. How does that happen in a seal's life?
Normally what happens is almost immediately, within the first day or two, moms will take their pups out into the water along the coastline. And so she's there, and she encourages the pup to come in, and he learns how to move his flippers and do all the normal things that seals do. What happened with KP2 was he was on the beach, one day old. He's now brought into captivity where human moms are going to try and fatten him up, so they're feeding him. But because of the logistics, he was kept in a dry pen area initially. So they get him fattened up, but now he's so fat that he's buoyant, and he gets into a pool situation, and he doesn't know how to get his tail up, his head up, you know, so he's upside down, he's flipping around in the water. And finally somebody said, oh my gosh, give him a boogie board, give him something to float on. And they did, and this pink boogie board became his favorite toy, it still is. And he knows how to surf as a result of it because he jumped on it and then started moving his hind flippers like a real seal and found that he could skirt around the pool. And eventually he learned how to swim from that, but he's a surfer first.
Mm-hmm. So when he did learn to swim and he winds up being such a hit on the beaches of Hawaii, and I think it was around Molokai, he also got himself into some big-time trouble, which is really the reason why you got him.
Yeah. So the history is that he was brought in, fattened up, everything was great, he learns to swim, and the National Marine Fisheries Service say, let's give him a shot. Let's see if he can make it in the wild. So at this point, he's only 7 months old. They decide to take him to Molokai, over to the side of the island that they used to have what was previously called leprosy, but Hansen's disease is the name we use now. But it was a colony which is absolutely isolated. And no one, you know, there are very few people that live there today, but the monk seals have taken up residence. So they fly him over to this remote beach, give him a little radio tag on his back, and follow his movements, and he swims first towards Oahu, then he reverses himself, goes around the island a few times, goes down, visits Lanakai, then ends up at the wharf on the opposite side of the island where kids are playing. And he's attracted to the movement. He had never seen small kids in the water before. And suddenly there's this bond that develops between this wild seal and these children. And he becomes a summer playmate for them, which is where, you know, the problem came in because the dogs were jumping into the water with him. There's actually a YouTube video that you can look up called Mac and KP2 or KP2 and Mac, where it shows one of the encounters with this Labrador retriever. But that was, you know, alarming to nymphs. They move the seal back to the remote side of the island. He swims back to the kids. And finally, there's a morning where a 70-year-old woman is going to go in for her morning swim, and the seal comes up behind her and grabs her like he did with the little kids. It's just that she didn't expect it. So suddenly, you know, she doesn't know what's going on. There's a potential for her drowning in her mind, and that was it. That was the final straw. Nymph said, we cannot have a seal doing this, especially when he starts to get to the age of an adult where he could weigh 400 pounds and take somebody for a 20-minute dive. So that was it. And that was when they had to find a home for this wild seal.
You're listening to Terry Williams, author of The Odyssey of KP2, An Orphan Seal, A Marine Biologist, and The Fight to Save a Species. The book is this year's campus read at Boise State, and Dr. Williams will be visiting our campus Tuesday, March 3rd, to present a public lecture.
I do think I remember reading, though, that even the 70-year-old woman came back at the end and argued for KP2. I don't know exactly what she was arguing for, but she was on his side.
That was it. I don't think that there was anybody that felt that they wanted the seal to lead a life that was going to be in a pool. And even to this day, and even while we had him, there was the hope that he would return out to the wild. But I think everyone in Molokai, you know, and the fishermen may smirk a little bit here, but, you know, I think there was a love of the seal from the kids on up to the 70-year-old woman who said, it was an accident. It was not where she felt the seal was trying to drown her. She just didn't know. And the whole time he was in California, I felt that immense pressure to bring the seal back to Hawaii. It was his home. He had to go back. I really had wished that it was going to be out in the wild. It's just that his biology wouldn't allow it.
So here you are down in Antarctica doing some kind of a research project, freezing. I mean, I got cold reading that part of the book. And you get this call, would you be willing to take this seal? How do you move a seal, transfer a seal from the Hawaiian Islands to your shop? And, of course, I know the answer to this, really, but I want you to describe Thanksgiving, your very special Thanksgiving with your new seal.
Yeah, that's right. So, I'm freezing in the Antarctic, and you have no idea about getting an email. Maybe it'd be like you guys in the middle of winter, where you'd get an email, and they said, hey, how would you like a tropical seal? And it sounds so great. You know, yes, take all the jackets, the boots, and the rest of it. Take me to an island. So on the way home from Antarctica, where I was studying Weddell seals, so I went from Antarctic seals to tropical seals, visited the back area of the Waikiki Aquarium, which is where he was being held, made the decision that we're just going to do this, right back to National Marine Fisheries and just say, sure, yeah, I'm going to do this. We had no money. I mean, it's not like I've got a big reserve of money that we can take in any orphaned animal, but I just said, yes, this is the right thing to do. So then we decided we had to figure out a way to get him to California. And the problem was that we normally use Federal Express for transferring animals. We've moved sea otters from Exxon Valdez that way, and we've moved Stellar sea lions that way. So it's not unprecedented. And we checked with Federal Express, but going across the ocean is a whole lot more complicated, and it was going to be $17,000. So I just bit into a $17,000 bill, and I was just agonizing. I didn't know what was going to happen. And as fate would have it, and that's one thing about this seal, he's just so bloody lucky at one level, the U.S. Navy was moving dolphins back from a mission, mine hunting mission, in New Caledonia. They were going to stop in Oahu, and they let the seal have a hitch a ride on that plane. So the plane goes across the ocean, brings the seal to San Diego, which is an 8 to 10 hour drive from Santa Cruz. So we decided we're going to take a little yellow Penske truck, and we'll truck the seal back up to Santa Cruz. The problem was that the day that the Navy had picked to move the dolphins was the day before Thanksgiving, the most traffic congested day of the year, and especially through Los Angeles. Well, here we were in a truck in the middle of all this traffic with an endangered species in the back of it. It was just, oh my gosh, it was just horrible. Fortunately, I was in the front of the truck doing the navigation. The trainers are in the back of the truck with the seal, with all the fish and the seal smell. And yeah, that's how we got him up to Santa Cruz at 3 o'clock in the morning. We finally arrived.
Well, one of my first stops when I hit the boundary of California is the In-N-Out Burger. And you actually made a stop at the In-N-Out Burger also, but in this case, you did it with a seal in the trunk.
Yeah. The seal had all the fish in the world in the back to eat. We were starving after sitting in that traffic. So, yes, we did take that seal to the bastion of good dining in California, In-N-Out Burger. We had the back of the truck open, and the seal started vocalizing. People with their dogs were walking by, and it's like I'm going, no, it's just a pit bull. Don't worry about it. He's fine.
Pit bull.
Yeah, it was great. It was the most embarrassing In-N-Out I've ever had.
So you get to the Santa Cruz lab. What does your lab look like, and who were KP2's neighbors?
Oh, golly. Our lab is a bunch of outcasts, I've decided. when I really took a look at it, here's KP2, the orphaned Hawaiian monk seal. The other animals of my lab consist of Puka and Primo, who are two ex-Navy mine-hunting dolphins that failed in the military. So they're there. We're studying the sounds or the effects of oceanic sounds on those guys. Then we've got sea otters that have failed from the Monterey Bay Aquarium rehab program, orphaned generally as youngsters, then set out in the wild, and for one reason or another, they do not do well, and so they're in my lab. Then we've got the birds. We have a collection of parrots and cockatoos and every imaginable bird that people can't take care of. Either they don't know how, or they've gotten too old, and they bring them to our doorstep and just say, "You have trainers here. Take this bird and do something with it." So that's the minimum we have in the lab. There are elephant seals and harbor seals. It's a zoo.
Terry, thank you so much for this conversation today. This has been so interesting that we're going to continue this right on into next week.
As a reminder, Terry Williams will visit Boise State on Tuesday, March 3rd. And will present a lecture in the Simplot Ballroom in the Student Union Building. Find out more at boisestate.edu. I hope you enjoyed this encore edition of our interview with Terry Williams. Next week, we'll continue our conversation with Dr. Williams in part two of our interview. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones, research by Kathleen Tuck. Our producer is Janelle Brown. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner. We invite you to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. To find us, search for Reader's Corner with Bob Kustra.